Good. It's now 8 o'clock in my time zone. I don't know what the time zones are. But anyhow, it's the time for the morning talk. And for this morning's talk, yesterday I started talking about the thousand petal lotus and how the next stage of meditation is inside the stage of meditation you're on right now. And that hopefully imprints a message inside of you that you don't need to go anywhere to go deeper into meditation. Stay where you are, and as you go more and more centered into where you are, then the next stage of meditation will appear. And that's all the way to the deepest of meditations, always going in, never going on. But today I wanted to talk about why it sounds so easy. And why do people find trouble with that? And the reason why people find trouble with the meditation is usually the five hindrances called Pancha Nivarana. So today's talk will be about the hindrances, and I'll see how many I can deal with. I know the first hindrance, you know, is about wanting desire, but then I'll go to the fourth hindrance instead first, which is restlessness. A wandering mind. But I must admit, when I go on a retreat like this, even though I'm teaching and doing some work, I do experience restlessness. I found that as the mind gets more and more peaceful, more energized, I rest less and less every evening, quite naturally. And to me, that's my definition of restlessness. Because otherwise you sleep too much. Now please remember, you can always catch up on your sleep in your coffin when you pass away. You can sleep as much as you like there. But nevertheless, it's good to have just the right amount of sleep at night. How much is the right amount of sleep? You don't really know. Just experiment. Because I realize over all these years of being a monk, if I'm very busy, you've got to make decisions, get your itineraries together, talk to other monks or lay people or whoever, or nuns, that they exist as well, sorry. That sometimes, you know, you get so busy, you do get mentally tired, you need more rest. But other times, especially when you do your own retreat, just in my cave, you don't do very much at all. And so the brain doesn't get tired, it doesn't need much rest. So you usually find your sleep requirements will change when you're doing a meditation retreat. So just because you wake up early in the morning, don't think, oh, I haven't slept enough. Check with your body, check with your mind, ask your body. Body, do you need some more sleep? Mind, you need some more rest? Just ask them. And a lot of times they'll say, no, I'm fine, I've had enough, even though it's very early in the morning. And you can sort of carry on meditating. The nice thing about being on a retreat is that it doesn't really matter if you get it wrong, you don't sleep enough. You can always catch up during my talk. I see many people just catch sleep. That's weird. Sometimes people say, a lot of lay people, I don't know if you do the same, they listen to my talks on YouTube at night time and then that sends them to sleep. I still don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And the other thing is, it was said very clearly in Berkeley at a conference I did a few years ago, where somebody was about to give a talk, and they introduced me. Please welcome Ajahn Brahm. I go to bed with him every night. What? You can sue someone for that. And all they were saying is they listen to one of the Dhamma talks in bed in the evening, and that just relaxes them and gets them into a nice state of meditation or peace or sleep or whatever it is. But anyway, the real restlessness, as you know, is not sort of jokes about having less need for being still or sleeping or resting. The real restlessness is that wandering mind. And it's a strange thing. Why can't you just be here and relax? Sometimes, in the first few days of the retreat or the middle of the retreat, It's a little bit cold these days, but it's not that cold during the middle of the day or the afternoon. If you feel you're restless, in other words, you know, mind is wandering all over the place, won't stay still, get yourself a cup of tea, delicious green tea. It was very nice of you to do that for me yesterday. Thank you. Or black tea, or yellow tea, or striped tea. I don't know what's available. Or a cup of coffee, or just an orange juice. And just sit in front of the dining room. And a beautiful view outside there. And you can just sit there with a cup of tea. You don't even need to drink it, just hold it. And then just enjoy the beautiful scenery. And you're not doing anything. It's not meditation. You're not trying to attain anything. I'll get the first deep meditation on tea drinking. All you're doing there is just relaxing. And if you want to know what to do, it's really nothing really, but sometimes people need somehow or other, need to be give whatever they're doing some sort of meaning. I always tell people, if I do that, sit there with a cup of tea just alone, I'd do that to see if I can see the trees grow. There's lots of trees out there. They do grow. That's for certain. Have you ever seen a tree grow? It's because you're not looking long enough. You're impatient. You've got to wait and see those trees. And they do grow, you know. So it's a good excuse for doing nothing. You know what it's like if you do that at home? You're in the garden, a cup of tea, and just watching the trees grow, and your partner comes and says, what are you doing? If you say nothing, they say, oh, great, can you come and help me? That's one of those stories about somebody called the monk up one evening, or one afternoon, and said, oh, is that the monk? Oh, great. Look, I really need someone to come and do a ceremony at my house, do some chanting. Are you free today? And the monk replied, no, I'm sorry, I'm busy today. He said, what are you doing today? He said, I'm doing nothing. That's what a monk is supposed to do, to relax and do nothing and teach by example. I'm just doing nothing. And because the fellow was a meditator who called up, he kind of understood, oh, okay, very good, carry on. So the monk hung up the phone, and then the same man called the next morning to the temple, asked the monk, oh, it's you again, great. Look, I really need a monk to come and do some chanting. It's really important for me. Are you free today? And the same monk said the same thing. No, I'm busy today. What are you doing today? And the monk replied, I'm doing nothing. He said, that's what you said yesterday. Correct, said the monk. I'm not finished yet. As a monk, I like that story. I thought that was really cool. Because isn't it important to finish relaxation, doing nothing first? And then you can do all those other jobs afterwards. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. That's the truth. So never do today what you can put off until tomorrow because you might die tonight. That's why I can never get a job as a layperson. Is it lazy or is it wise? But now I'm a head monk. I tell that to the other monk. You know what happens. They relax too, which is great. So that's why you can go and sit in that veranda. Oh, actually, another beautiful place to sit is just right in front of here. I don't know if you check this place out. Not many people go there, in front of this hall, just in front there. It's so quiet, so peaceful there. There's lots of room. You can get a chair and sit there and just spend, you know, an hour drinking a cup of tea. Just relaxing, watching the trees grow. And you find you can sit down there and rest. You can just rest your body, rest your mind, rest your brain so it doesn't have to think so much. And if that can be done, just sitting down there, just watching the trees grow, because nature is always beautiful, there's always new things which happen, you find that, what's the problem with restlessness? Why can you can watch the trees grow, you can sit by the lake and watch. Actually, there's no ducks around right now, is there? Usually not this time of year. Maybe there's polar bears because it's so cold. I don't know what's down there. But anyway, you can sit down in nature and watch it. For some reason, though, if it doesn't move, it is tranquilizing, it's calming, it's peaceful. And the beauty of what you're seeing is usually more attractive than the importance you give to the thoughts, which you think are important to think about, and solutions to be able to solve. But it's always been my experience, my own and other people telling me the same, that if you really do have a problem, something you really need to think about, it's important, the best ways of getting solutions is by not thinking about it. There was one of the ladies who used to come here. Actually, she's got her ashes buried here in what we call the secret garden. Waninat, her name was. And she came on one of my retreats once over when we used to hold these retreats in town. We didn't have this facility then. And there's always problems in that time because we held the retreats in a Catholic retreat center. Some people had a difficult time going to Catholic schools when they were young, just seeing crucifixes all over the place. They just really got a bit upset. I didn't feel sort of comfortable. But even better than that, because there was a church right next door, that once when I was teaching a retreat there and I started giving the talk, it was on one of these microphones, which was a wireless microphone. And then after 5 minutes, the priest from the church came running in. He said, "Please, turn it off. "Why?" "I'm just giving my talk." He said, "Yes, but the frequency which you've got is the same as the frequency we've got in the church. And instead of my sermon, they're listening to you." So anyhow, so we got this place, which is very nice. But in that place, there's one lady, she came very late. She had one of these very difficult jobs in the Department of Social Work, Social Services. She was a very, very competent woman. But her job, she told me, was really high stress. She was the person who was assigned the final call on when children would be taken away from their parents because the parents were considered to be too much of a danger to their children. Now, it was just a really difficult piece of paper to sign, and she was the one who had to sign it. She had to consider the need, obviously, for a child to be with its mother and the benefits of mother having a child there, which is really important. But sometimes, if the mother was a drug dealer or violent or something that... it was dangerous for the child. So she had to make that decision or find some solution somehow to these very, very difficult problems in life. So anyway, she came very late one evening to the retreat. And again, I told her, just rest first of all, catch up with your sleep, which she did. And then she started meditating. But in the interview, she came up after 4 or 5 days. She came up and said, "Ajahn Brahm, look, I haven't been thinking about all the work which I have to complete when I get back to work after the retreat is finished. I just now dropped all of that. But I was meditating and getting very peaceful, a really nice meditation, and then all these solutions came up to the work which I was doing. And they were just such amazing, innovative solutions. That I wasn't thinking about the problems. They just came up by themselves. So I went back to my room, wrote them all down, and I forgot them. I'll implement them when I go back to work on Monday." But what really struck her was just how beautiful those solutions were, which you could never get by just thinking about them or contemplating them. It's just by letting them be and letting the solutions come up by themselves. And that's a common experience of those people who can let things go, let their brain relax, and let their mind get powerful, and all these incredible innovative solutions come up. And I also always make reference to this fellow called Brian Josephson, who is, as far as I still know, the only Welshman who's ever won the Nobel Prize for Physics. He was up at Cambridge, and he got his great insight into quantum tunneling, which made the foundation for supercomputing. And he got his great insight once he came out of meditation. He was a meditator. And he emerged from meditation, and these solutions to these very, very difficult problems came up. And he got a Nobel Prize for that. So look, a lot of times we have problems to solve. They're important problems. But if we keep on just thinking about them, we just think about them in the same old way. We never make breakthroughs into new ground. It's just old thinking, old different ways of saying the same things, but nothing which is really new. But when the mind becomes very still, and when you come out of that stillness, your mind's got great power, can see things in a different way. Just the old channels, the old ruts of thinking have gone beyond those. See new ways of thinking, new ways of seeing, new insights. I like telling those stories because the main reason is that I don't think many of you are going to get a Nobel Prize. Who knows, maybe, but unlikely, to be honest. But nevertheless, many of you value thinking too much and don't see the value of pausing, of being still, of resting the brain. Then afterwards, your brain is working at full potential. So if you really do want to be an effective problem solver, stop thinking and be still instead. See the value of that stillness, which is the opposite of a wandering mind. So that's the first lesson, is just to see the value in stillness and take more value away from thinking. I'm sure I could have been a good monk so much earlier in life, but these things weren't emphasized for me. I remember being in school, and sometimes your mind was very peaceful, and then the teacher would say to me, "Peter, what do you think about that?" I said, "Nothing, stupid," they called me, because I didn't think. They taught me to think. They taught me that just being still and not thinking at all and was being sort of not wise. But of course the opposite is the case. So when you value stillness more than thinking, it's easier to overcome restlessness. Because the mind will always go to what it finds more interesting, more important. And it's hard, you know, to control that. So, if you do have this habit of thinking too much and being restless, never being able to stay in one place, a lot of time it's because you don't see the value, the beauty, the benefit of just being here. It's not something you can just do and say, "Okay, I'm going to see the benefit of just being here and not going anywhere else." This is like a training in your habits. And those habitual tendencies of your mind take a long time to actually to train, to see different ways. Not training by force, but by training by wisdom. And that wisdom training is to see the benefits of silence, of stillness. But the other one of the other great ways of overcoming restlessness is also understanding just what restlessness truly is. And I think I told this similarly the last retreat I gave, not here but somewhere else. And on that retreat I think it was over in Indonesia. In that retreat I said that all the way from Australia to Indonesia, it was in Medan, I said, "I never flew here." And I was shocked. I said, "Well, how did you get here then, if you didn't fly here?" I said, "I didn't fly here. I just went in the aircraft. I sat down on my seat. The aircraft did the flying. I just sat." Just a little different perspective. I can't fly. I can fall, I can drop, but I can't fly. The aircraft does that, but all I do, I get it in the aircraft and sit down. And so if you're sitting down, you're being more honest, it's just a different perspective. I just sat all the way from Perth to Medan. I never flew at all. The same with what is restlessness? Can we look at it in a different way? And you can look at it in a different way. All you're really saying, most people are saying when they're restless, they cannot stay with their breath because they think that's all they're supposed to do, just watch their breath. Or if I say watch the bodily feelings, they can't watch the bodily feelings, they watch something else. So how can you overcome restlessness? You choose what to watch and you go and watch something else. That's basically what restlessness is. So that is overcome very powerfully with the old Emperor's Three Questions meditation, which I've already mentioned several times. It's a great meditation. And the Emperor's Three Questions, now is the only time you have. Most important meditation object is what's right in front of you right now. And the most important thing to do is to care. How can you be restless if you practice that meditation? Whatever's in front of you right now, that's the most important meditation object, no matter what it is. So then you have one meditation object, you see your breath right now, the next moment you see body awareness, the next moment you see Kasina, the next moment you see Satipatthana, the next moment you see something else. That's what you're supposed to do. Whatever's right in front of you right now is the most important object. Don't choose the object. The object chooses you. So you just watch what's here right now. What do you do with it? You're caring for it. You're kind to it. You're not trying to change it. You know, there's stories about those Emperor's Three Questions, and the last one especially, what's the most important thing to do? That was that story of, I don't mind saying his name now, his name is Sumedha Gahanagi. He was, you know, we see these little kids come into the monastery here, and sometimes if the kids come in here with their mums to give you food, please just be kind to them. They're playful, they're not on the eight precepts, they're not on noble silence. The mum would love them to be, but no, they're playful, and I welcome that playfulness, that naughtiness, because I want them to feel happy when they come and visit a monastery. And when they feel happy, it becomes their home. They're never afraid of this place. And when they feel that this is their monastery, their temple, these are their monks and nuns, enormous benefits come later on. And this particular benefit, this young man, Sumedha, usually over here, they call him Sam, he was, he studied really hard. You know, you saw him ever since he was about 6 years of age or 5 years of age. And now he was went through school, did well at the school exams, went to university, studied medicine, became a doctor. It was his first year at the Perth Hospital. And in the first year there, on a Saturday morning, he came to see me in Nolamara, and he was very, very disturbed. And because that morning at Royal Perth Hospital, one of his patients had unexpectedly died. Now, she wasn't really on the critical list, but she went into the dying process, and he was the person in charge of her. He tried everything he could, but he couldn't keep her alive. And the problem, real problem was, then he, being the doctor in charge of this patient on this Saturday morning, had to go and meet this lady's husband. The lady was only 23, husband only a year or two older. And they'd just been, you know, married only a couple of years, and they were still very, very much in love. And saying this news, you know, to a young husband, unexpectedly, with not much warning, his wife had died, and he had to tell her the news. He wasn't prepared for that. He did the best he could, but it really hurt him, having to convey, you know, news to her husband, who was in shock. Just to make it worse, this man, the husband, had their two children with them. And they had to tell, you know, you've got no mummy anymore. Your mummy's died. And I think you can imagine what that's like. You know, and he thought, I just can't do this anymore. It was too painful. You know, when they did the autopsy or whatever, inquest, it was not his fault. It was just something which no doctor would have been able to spot. But nevertheless, he thought, this is going to happen again. I can't do this anymore. So he came up and asked me for some advice, and he said, I think I'm going to have to resign and find another job. And he was a sensitive, really nice guy. But anyway, I told him, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. The purpose of being a doctor is not to cure your patients. If you think it's to cure your patients, you will be a failure many times. And not your fault. Even if you cure them, it's only cure them temporarily. We all have to go eventually. It's only a temporary cure. Eventually we go. But I said, your job is not to cure. Your main purpose in life is to care for your patients and care for their families. And that makes a huge difference. People tell me that they go into hospital and sometimes the nurses and the doctors don't have any time to care for you. They've got to just take your temperature, take your blood temperature, record everything, just go down and write it up and write out a report and see another patient. You don't have time just to hold your hand and just have a chat about, you know, how do you feel, what's going on. They don't have the time to care. And I mentioned to him, curing, you'll always fail. Caring, you can always succeed, no matter what. So make caring your main purpose as a doctor. Curing is like the beneficial side effects. And I also explained to him, he understood very well, that if you make caring more important than curing, you'll probably, the amount of patients you cure will also increase. But it also means you never need to feel a failure, and you're also caring for the patients' families as well. And he got it. And he sort of went back to work. And of course, I did, I think, mention earlier, he's a colonoscopist. So any time any monks, I don't know if the nuns ever need a colonoscopy, but he'd be very happy to help anybody because I helped him, kept his career. This is like gratitude and love for the wisdom of the Sangha. But it's more than that. Any one of you, you have a partner in life, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, or whatever, partner. Are they perfect? Do they always do what they should be doing? And if they don't, are you trying to cure their bad habits? If you try and cure their bad habits, you will be a failure. Care for them. And if you care rather than cure, you'll find your happiness and your success rates will surprise you. They'll go through the roof. Your bad habits. You don't need to tell them to me. Your bad habits. Are you trying to cure them? Or are you trying to care for them? All the stuff like the bad habits in meditation, restlessness. Are you trying to cure restlessness? That's its cause, trying to cure it. Care for it. When you care for it, you'll find the restlessness hasn't got much hope. It'll disappear. It's like caring for the anger-eating demon. That's what the Empress did. And the soldiers, they try to cure it, get it out. So please remember, caring is way more powerful than curing. And that's how we overcome our restlessness. You're restless, so you think. Care for that, it's quite normal. It's not that there's something wrong with you, it's not got some disease like a COVID, and I need to sort of quarantine you because, you know, you're just too restless. No. Remember the Emperor's three questions. Right now, what are you aware of right now? Care for it. Don't try and get rid of it. And then you find you're always mindful of where you're supposed to be, which is right now. And what you're aware of is you're being aware of it. How can you ever call that restlessness? Number two, because you're caring, you'll find a lot of these things which, you know, you're aware of this and aware of that. After a while, everything calms down. The care creates calm. Cure creates more business to be done. So caring for this moment, you find after a while you're just here all the time. Where you are is many different places, but you're always here. You've actually solved the problem of restlessness. But it's not just that. I also found, I remember once just asking myself, why? Why is it that I get restless? And please excuse me for some of the subject matter of this anecdote, but, you know, I have to say it because it was real. I had a 6 year as a monk. I found this idyllic monastery in which to meditate. I've got so many beautiful stories of this monastery. It was up close to the Burmese border in the hill country above Chiang Mai. And so many wonderful things about this place. Number one, it was in the middle of a tea plantation. And you notice I'm English and how much I love tea. I had a whole plantation I was in the middle of. As much tea as you could drink. And all for free, obviously, because I was a monk. And number two, they had this beautiful cave. I mean, a really deep cave, which I used to go in every morning and afternoon. And just after I had my one meal of the day, went in that cave. And that cave gave me many stories. One of those stories I've mentioned to a few of you, my favorite smells and fragrances. One of those favorite smells is the smell of tar. You know, that black coal or oil-based thing which people use to paint onto things. And the reason for that is because I had so many happy months when I was growing up playing soccer in the park. And in the park, the railings, they couldn't have metal railings, they'd all been taken away to make bombs for the Second World War. So they used wood and they had to paint it with tar in order to preserve it. So they used to paint it, you know, every 6 months. And that smell was always in a place I loved, playing soccer with my friends. And I'm not joking, to this day when I smell tar, it's a beautiful smell because it's associated with happy memories. Even the other day, about 6 months ago, they were re-tarring the bottom of the Southwest Highway, the bottom of Kingsbury Drive. And when I smelled that, I thought, wow, that's tar. It just gave me joy. And said, well, you're really mad at your bum. You like tar, you don't like other things like, you know, like jasmine or no, I like tar. And my other favorite smell is bat poo. Honest. And the reason I love the smell of bat poo was because in that cave there was millions of bats and they were just resting and I was just meditating. We got on together very well. But it stank of bat poo. I had such lovely meditations in there. To this day, bat poo is one of my second most favorite smells. So those are the smells I love, just because of association. And also, you know, the story I often tell about what happens if you do something wrong or bad or stupid and you know, you have a lot of suffering because of some decision you made in life or some decision other people made and it makes you suffer, you get traumatized. And that story about if you tread in the dog poo, what should you do? Don't scrape it off yet. Bring it home and scrape it off under the mango tree or the apple tree or whatever other fruit you like. And that story came directly from in front of that cave. I was meditating there for about 6 months. When you came out, there was a single papaya tree in front of that cave. And of course, because the cave had a narrow entrance, that's where all the bats would come and poo on that tree or just around it. And the reason I always remember that papaya tree, because my goodness, I've never ever tasted to this day any papaya as sweet and juicy and as tasty as the papayas on that tree. It was just so delicious. Then I was the only monk in this monastery, staying there by myself. And when any of the lay people came, I said, oh, come and have a look at this. Oh, look, there's a papaya there, just ripe. Because I can't ask for anything. I can't say, go and get it for me. I just give all the hints, as many as I could. And they come and get it for me. And I'd eat the whole thing. You know how big a papaya is. Nothing would be wasted. Because it's absolutely delicious. And that's where the story of the not the dog poo in this case, the bat poo comes from. So I had some wonderful times up there. But then at one time, you know that sometimes you have a good meditation retreat, but sometimes you get into a space of restlessness. And over a couple of days, my mind got really restless. And I didn't have anyone to talk to. I was there by myself. And the sort of things I was thinking about, there's no way I could ask the lay people to help. I'd be too embarrassed, because always like, you know, unmonkish thoughts, old girlfriends, you know, sexual fantasies. That's what I was thinking about. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, I don't want to disrobe, but I wonder if she's still available. No, stop it, Ajahn Brahm. That's what happened. I'm being honest with you. And so the more I tried to stop this, the more powerful those thoughts became. It was like almost like Finney, you're going crazy. And then so what happened, I couldn't stand this much longer. I went to the big Buddha statue, which was in the main hall. All the Thai temples have Buddha statues. So I bowed three times and just said, help. That's the only thing I could think of doing. And an idea came up, and the idea was, do a deal. That's what Westerners, actually these days all over the world, that's what they do deals. So my deal was, mind, you stay with your breath, do it properly, but if you want to think about all these unmonkish thoughts, fantasies and memories and stuff, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon, you can think whatever you want. The rest of the day, you behave. I thought that was fair. If your mind wanted to indulge in sexual fantasies, old girlfriends, stuff like that, fine. 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. The rest of the day, you watch your breathing. This is a true story. And so I made that deal in front of the Buddha to give it some seriousness. And then I carried on meditating. It was just as difficult as ever. I tried to watch my breath and the thoughts would just come straight into my mind. However much I tried to guard the mind, they came bashing through any door which I'd put up. They were just so powerful. And I started thinking these stupid thoughts and I go, come watch the breath. Breath going in, going out. Well, she was very nice. No, stop it. And when it came to 3 p.m., I went up to my room. And I'm very honest. If I promise something, I'll keep that promise if I possibly can. I leant my back against the wall because I was tired. And I said, okay, now, whoever you want to think about, whatever you want to think about, I'm not going to put any barriers up. If you want to think about the most ridiculous, weirdest, sexual, perverted fantasy, fine. That's the deal. Then for the next hour, I watched every breath without any problem whatsoever. There was no restlessness at all. And that actually happened. And that really surprised me. What is going on? When I try to stay with the breath, you get all these stupid thoughts. When you let go, all you have is just breath going in, breath going out. So peaceful. What I realized was it was my mind teaching me, don't control me. Be a friend. And then all these things started to make sense. I know that some friends I've known for years and years and years, you know, before I became a monk. Sometimes I met one of these friends once, well, many times obviously. I was visiting UK and we had a meeting up of the old friends when I was at Cambridge, and he was one of them. His name was Harold, and he told me he'd done very well in life, and he was the head actuary. An actuary is like an accountant, but just, you know, a couple of levels up. He works out all the probabilities, you know, of accidents and stuff to enable the insurance companies to work out premiums. And he was brilliant at this. He was the head actuary of the whole of Europe. So, you know, very sort of well-known and well-regarded person. And of course, when he came, he was in his suit, I was in my robes. But of course, you remembered each other straight away. And when I greeted him, it was, "Hi, Flash, how are you going?" Flash was his nickname at college. And he said, "Please don't use that word." I said, "Why not? Look, I'm the head actuary. This is an important position. If people found out why you call me Flash, I'll be in big trouble." "Ah, don't worry, people have got a good sense of humour." Because Harry got the word Flash at one of the parties, which I held in my rooms over in Cambridge. He got drunk, he went to the toilet, and he forgot to put his trousers on when he came out. We saw everything, and from that day on, his nickname was Flash Harry. He said, "I'm the head actuary, that's really important. So please don't say that." Well, no. So anyway, that many of these things which we try to suppress, sometimes the more we suppress them, the more power we give them. So these thoughts which you have, just be aware of them, just be them. Don't try and get rid of them. Care for them. Don't try and cure them. And, you know, even though Flash, he was a head accountant, I was a monk, you know, he was making lots of money, I was just renouncing all the money. But we spent hours together. You know, I'd already arranged, you know, to have a lunch in the Sri Lankan restaurant. He came with me. And it was the first time ever, instead of actually paying attention to the donors and talking to them. I did give them a blessing afterwards, but I was talking to my friend Harold all the time. And then we still hadn't finished our conversation after having this lunch, so we went, I was going to give a talk at the Thai temple, so we went on the underground together to Wimbledon. And then we were talking all the way, and when I got into the temple, I was still talking to him. I was supposed to give a talk to others, they were all waiting for me. And as I looked, "No, I'd rather talk with you, but I've got to talk to these other people." He understood, and so he left me. But we could have carried on talking for hours. He was a really good friend in those days. So it told me something as well. If you're with a very good friend, you don't need to actually focus and concentrate to stay with them. You have this wonderful relationship. And that relationship of kindness means you just can hardly separate yourself from them. And I realized that's what I should be doing with something like my meditation object. And that's, you know, I pretty much succeeded in that. Because when I see my breath and I, we're just like really close friends. We've had such a wonderful time together in the past, my breath and I. Oh, we spent hours together chilling out, enjoying the deep peace of meditation. So my breath and I are one of my best friends. And Nimitta, "Hey Nimitta, nice of you to come and see me. Wow, let's hang out together." That's not an exaggeration. You get excited to see these beautiful old friends you spent so much wonderful time together with. You don't need to go and hold a Nimitta. The Nimitta comes to you and just, we hang out together. Literally like that, you know, hanging out, chilling out together because of the wonderful times you've had together. Now that is just how we overcome restlessness. Changing our attitude towards, say, our mind. I know mind, you know, sometimes you like to think of all sorts of stupid things. That's fine by me, you're a mind. And you just let your mind be. You don't try and control it. When you try to control your mind, that is the problem. Have you ever had, those of you who had kids, you try and control your kids and they throw a tantrum. I don't like you, Mummy. Like that great story of one of the women here in Perth. She told me this story, absolutely beautiful story. It's about restlessness. Her kid's 6 or 7 years of age, some school holiday, so he was at home with his mummy. And one day he told his mummy, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving home." It's only 6 or 7, okay? "You want to leave home?" "Yes, Mummy." "Okay, I will help you pack." I know that some of you mummies would sort of think about that many times. "Oh, I'll be free of my kid, he's left home at 6 o'clock." But you know you can't really get away with that. But this woman said that. She said, "Okay, I'll help you pack." So he packed a little bag with all the important things of life, like the Spider-Man costume, and I forget what else, lucky underpants. She helped him pack, he chose. That was important. Mummy never said, "No, you should take this, you should take that." He chose what to put in his suitcase. And then when he packed it all up, Mummy said, "You know, it's a long journey in life. Just to get you started, I'll make you some sandwiches, your favorite sandwiches." And so she made his sandwiches for her kid and put them in a nice little bag. And then he went to the front door of the house and Mummy kissed him. "Have a wonderful life, son. Don't forget to, you know, to call or check in every now and again." "Yes, I will, Mummy, I will, Mummy. Thank you, Mummy." And then he, with his suitcase, I never saw this, but I can always imagine it, with a suitcase and a brown paper bag with his favourite sandwiches in it. Then he went down the garden path to the front gate, opened the gate, went through the gate, and then turned left to go down the street, to go into his life, leaving home for the first time at 7 years of age. After about 2 or 3 minutes, maybe 100 meters down the road, he got terribly homesick, thinking, "Why would I want to leave a mummy like this?" He turned around, walked back to the gate, opened the gate, went through the gate, down the path. Mummy hadn't moved. "Welcome home, son." And that was a beautiful example of emotional intelligence. If she had hit the kid or locked him up and said, "No, you're not going to move, son, you can't go, you're too young to leave home," then that wouldn't have had the same effect as trusting the little kid and say, "Okay, off you go." And she knew the son can't sort of be apart from a lovely mummy like that for too long. And so came back again, and the problem was solved. So your brain or your mind runs off somewhere. What should you do? Please pack its bags, give it a sandwich. "Okay, mind, wherever you want to go, off you go, but don't forget to check in every now and again." Your mind won't go very far. Why would a mind want to leave someone who just cares for it, doesn't want to control it, who loves it and shows that love? So if your mind wants to run off somewhere, pack its bags, and just wave it off. "Bye-bye, mind." It won't go very far. It will come back pretty quickly. And the last story about restlessness, we used to use this very often in Thailand, because the first years we were there in this monastery which we made, which its first name was Wat Bar. Now, Wat is the name of a temple. Bar is forest. Forest monastery. Wat Bar America Wat. Awas, and Awat, that's Thai. And it was later became Wat Bar Nana Cha. The reason we called it Wat Bar America Wat was because most of the monks who were there, first of all, were American nationalities. So Ajahn Chah called it America Wasa, America Wat. So anyway, when it had that name, in the mornings, you know, during the dry season, the villagers would take their water buffalo out to graze.
and a path led right past our Wat Bah America Wat. And so one, those water buffalo could be dangerous. I've kind of figured out the theory that when they saw a monk in these types of robes, the water buffalo's eyes were not very good. Their ears were good, so they could notice much of the stuff around them by hearing. So when they went past like a remnant jungle, that's you know what the monastery was, if they saw or heard something there, like a monk just coming out, then they'd obviously be a bit scared as a jungle animal. They didn't know it was a human being. But then they would try and see it, and all they'd see was like brown robe stuff, something brown and big. And I'm pretty sure that psychology, those water buffalo would think tiger. That's why every now and again the neighbours, for one reason or another, try and do a kangaroo cull. You know, like shooting kangaroos because they invade their farm. And they usually call us up saying, look, we're doing a kangaroo cull. And they do that because we have to tell our monks, please don't go outside. Because in the dark, they see these brown-robed beings. And the difference between a brown-robed monk and a kangaroo, not that much. And I think that's actually why the water buffalo chases the monks, or they get scared and run away. But anyway, it's going past the monastery, holding the water buffalo, just end up with a string, because the water buffaloes are just so docile, they don't harm anything at all. And a walking path, and then you know that there's something going on with the water buffalo, it raises its head up. And then when the water buffalo raised its head, it's obviously scared by something. The farmer tried to hold it by the string, and then the water buffalo ran off. And what did the farmer try and do? Try and restrain the water buffalo, trying to hold it. Who is stronger, a water buffalo or a Thai farmer? There's no contest. Water buffalo is far stronger. So in this case, it's pretty gross. The string wrapped around the man's finger. When the water buffalo ran off, it took half the finger with it. It ripped it off. So this poor farmer came into the monastery with half a finger, lots of blood on his hand. He wasn't so much in pain yet because of the shock was still there. So we took him to the hospital, patched him up, and he just had no half a finger on his hand from that time on. But we used that as an example of restlessness. Who is stronger, your mind or your will? If your mind wants to run off, let it go. Otherwise, you can sometimes rip some of your happiness off, especially trying so hard, and you'll lose. Instead, let the mind run off. And like the water buffalo, it only runs off 100 meters. It doesn't go too far. And then you can just walk after it and get hold of the string and take it to where it's supposed to go. If your mind runs off, let it run off. It won't go too far. Then you can actually, for some reason or another, the mind has got a bit spooked. Let it sort of run off, and then you can be with it afterwards. And because you're kind to it, it will stay with you. And that's actually how you overcome restlessness. And then restlessness just disappears. It's not a big problem anymore. And I say that because many of you, you know, Western meditators, even Asian meditators these days, they always say that's the biggest of the hindrances, the biggest problem, the restlessness of the mind. And it causes so much strife for you, and it doesn't need to. So, if you are sitting down here, you're restless, why? It's not because you're not putting enough force in or because you can't meditate. No, stay with that restlessness. Don't try and cure it. Care for it. And just, why is it the mind is restless? It's because you're, please excuse me, a control freak. And the mind resists being controlled. So instead, you just stay with wherever you are. whatever's happening right now, that's the mindfulness, that's the object of mindfulness you should stay on. Whatever's happening now. Whatever's happening now. Whatever's happening now. You're always aware of something. That's what you should be aware of. So the restlessness does not have no meaning anymore. And you care for it. And you'd be surprised at how quickly your mind settles down. And you're aware of so many things, and so many unwholesome things at first. But then you're aware of it, and you're caring for it. What you're doing with it is caring. You're not fighting it. You're not making a war with it. Because you're caring for it, you're making good karma, good meditation karma. You're not fighting. You're not having ill will. You're not having wanting. You're just caring. So after a short while, the mind calms down, becomes very bright. What you watch is usually, you know, you start off with the mind all over the place, but whatever place it's in, you're in there with it. And after a while, it all settles down. You'd be surprised with that type of wisdom how easy it is to overcome restlessness. Wherever you are, that's where you are too. That's how I fly from place to place. I never go anywhere. I never have a sense of movement when I'm sitting in a plane. I'm sitting still. The plane is doing the moving, not me. So with restlessness, the objects may change, but you're always there, still, just being with them, watching them, caring for them. And you find that's a beautiful way of overcoming this thing which we call restlessness. Goodness gracious. It's 4 minutes to nine. That's only one hindrance. Okay. Well, please experiment, listen to what I say, because restlessness is not that hard to overcome with wisdom. You can never overcome it with force, not with willpower. Willpower adds to the restlessness, it empowers it. The kindness and the wisdom is how it's overcome. Sadhu! Sadhu! Sadhu!